Listeners, are you a mother? Probably. Do you have a mother? Are you not a mother, but you have a mom you want to celebrate? Mother's Day is coming, y'all. Mother's Day is around the corner. And if you've listened to the Lucky Bee podcast for a little while, you know that we have a dream of creating a t-shirt line called Put It On A Shirt. And you also know that we have probably 700 brilliant t-shirt ideas, at least. Okay, I'm exaggerating, but we like to think that we have really great t-shirt ideas, and we always joke about putting things on a shirt, but we've actually done it on a couple of things, and we have a shirt that says, I am a really good mom. I'm a really good mom, because we say that on the podcast, because it's true, and it's true for you, and Mother's Day is coming up. And so if you want to head over there, we also have Lucky Mama gear. We've got hats and sweatshirts and t-shirts that say Lucky Mama. If you want to head over there and grab a shirt for yourself that you're going to wear on Mother's Day, because no one's going to get you a gift and everyone needs to be reminded that you are a really good mom, or you want to grab a shirt for the mom in your life, head on over to theluckyfew.co, theluckyfew.co, and we're offering just for a few more weeks a 21% discount on all Mother's Day orders. So 21% discount on Mother's Day orders. Use code LUCKYMAMA over at theluckyfew.co. Because you know what? You are a really good mom. Hey, Lucky Few podcast listeners. It is going to be a great episode today. It is time to shout some worth and shift some narratives for people with Down syndrome. Today, we have passionate advocate and physician, Dr. Emily Johnson. She's not only a primary care physician, but also holds the important role of sister and mother to individuals with Down syndrome. She's here to share her expertise and insights on what happens when our loved one with Down syndrome ages out of pediatric care and how families can prepare for this important transition. Listeners, welcome to the Lucky Few podcast.
Hey friends, it's Micah. I'm so thrilled to let you know that my second book, Blessed Are the Rest of Us, How Limits and Longing Make Us Whole, is in bookstores everywhere. This book is a memoir about my life with Ace, who has a dual diagnosis of autism and Down syndrome. And it's an exploration of the way loving someone with a disability has transformed my understanding of what it means to be whole. I hope you'll go to Target, Barnes & Noble, Amazon, or your local bookstore to buy Blessed Are the Rest of Us. Or you can order from Baker Bookhouse online and get 40% off when you use the code SLOWAY at checkout. That's S-L-O-W-W-A-Y. Thanks, friends.
All right, let's get right to it, friends. I want to tell you a little bit more about our guest today. Dr. Emily Johnson is a family and physician advocate for all people with Down syndrome. She currently works as a primary care physician at the Timothy Freeman MD Center for Developmental Disabilities at UC Health and is an assistant professor of family and community medicine at the University of Cincinnati. Before her current position, she served as a medical director of the Developmental Disabilities Health Center in Colorado Springs, Colorado. She is a fellow of the American Academy of Developmental Medicine and on the board of the American Academy of Developmental Medicine and Dentistry. She assists many patients in her professional role in the transition from the pediatric to adult healthcare systems and has presented on this topic to both medical students and for community organizations. Perhaps most importantly, she holds the roles of mother and sister to individuals with Down syndrome, Eric and Noah. Dr. Johnson, we're so grateful you're here. Welcome to the Lucky Few podcast.
Thanks for having me.
We're so, so grateful you're taking the time. I know you have a lot going on in your life, and I'm wondering if you can just start by letting our listeners and me, because it's our first time meeting, know about your personal and professional journey with individuals with Down syndrome. Let's start with personal, because we know you have a brother and a child with Down syndrome.
Yeah. So I guess my journey starts at birth, really, as I'm a younger sibling.
Okay.
My older brother has Down syndrome. So I had the fortunate experience of growing up in this world where it was just normal. And Down syndrome's been a part of my life for my whole life. Mm-hmm. So as a child, I spent a lot of time at Special Olympics, you know, volunteering at camps or doing camps alongside my brother. And it was just a great experience. You learn about some things kind of backwards there, where you start to like understand why or how society kind of sees people with Down syndrome rather than about Down syndrome itself. And that can be an interesting and sometimes difficult experience, but one I wouldn't trade for anything.
Okay, I'm going to interrupt you. I want to know more about that backwards learning about Down syndrome. Can you unpack that a little bit?
Yeah. So especially when you're a younger sibling, you know, your early years are this experience where your brother's just your brother, same as I also have a younger brother. So early on, that feels to me the same, or at least as I remember it. You know, I had different relationships with them, but they were both my brother and there was nothing unique about either one. And so then as you grow older and you start to, one, have an identifiable concept of what Down syndrome is and somebody teaches you what it is at some point in time, which I can't say I specifically remember, then you start to see how people with Down syndrome are experiencing the world, I guess. Mm-hmm. And so rather than having this big learning curve about what Down syndrome is, I had a bigger learning curve about how people outside of my family or outside of the Down syndrome community view Down syndrome. And then this experience of like deciding what I wanted to do with that information, mm-hmm. if that makes sense. And so I had this really close relationship and still do with my brother. And it was hard to see that not everyone saw him as an individual the way that I think I did and still do. And so there would be different like points in time at which that might be easier or harder. But I remember college being a particular transition for me because all of a sudden I was in a world, I moved out of state for college and nobody knew my brother yet. And so it was this experience of like, oh, what do you have any idea? I have a brother with Down syndrome. You hear all of the unfiltered comments that sometimes can be hard to hear. And so you're like, okay, how do I approach this in this new world? And then I had a similar transition going to medical school, I think, because in my head, we had a great pediatrician and felt very welcomed and supported as a whole family with that pediatrician. But when you're in medical school, you realize there's still a lot of bias and issues with the medical system as it comes to supporting people with disabilities. And so that, again, was this like next learning stage of how it was different than what I expected and different than what I experienced. And what to do with that as a part of my career. And so there's those kind of like little transitions and learning stages, I think, as a sibling along the way that are just different than I think what families experience when they are parents or maybe a sibling that's a lot older than their other sibling with Down syndrome. Something I've reflected on a lot over time.
Yes. Okay. Thank you for sharing that. Okay. Emily, I appreciate you being honest about that. I feel like you just dropped a lot of gold for a lot of us parents because I have my oldest has Down syndrome, my second doesn't, mm-hmm. then my third does, and my middle daughter is 13. And like that idea of there was never a moment of this is what Down syndrome is, but I can mm-hmm. think of times when she's like, wait, my oldest daughter's name is Mason, like why is Mason not here? Like why isn't this working for Mason? And mm-hmm. it's like, oh honey, they don't, like we're trying to make it work and the adults in charge can't make it happen. So we actually can't go to the places you go to as easily. And that watching her realize that even in her in adolescence, it's just very normal to be incredibly self-centered, right? Like to only be thinking of yourself, but then to have that happen. And as the parent to try to figure out how to navigate that where it's like no pressure on her. I know this isn't a conversation about siblings. However, I have a couple more questions.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if you can share with listeners, we have a lot of parents listening. We have siblings and medical and educators. We've got like the gamut who listens, but I'd say our majority of our listeners are moms. Mm-hmm. If you have like something that your parents that you can reflect on that you're like, my parents did this well when it came to me being the sibling of a person with Down syndrome, Is that an okay question to ask?
Yeah. I think about this a lot too, especially as I am relatively early in the parenthood journey myself. But I think, and I wish I could give like really concrete steps of how to achieve this, but I had this kind of sense lesson that they taught me that was basically like some sort of balance between, you know, supporting my brother and figuring out how to include him in things and just having it be a normal part of our lives, but also not having expectations on my own experience that I had to do anything in particular that, you know, a child would otherwise not necessarily have to do. So I very much felt like it was both this very inclusive environment, but also one in which I could still be my own person. And I think to get to the point where I am and really wanting to support people, being able to do both was really important. Like I had my own things, I was supported and all that stuff, but if I wanted to also be involved in the disability community, I could. And so that balance, I think, is one of the things that is just so important for siblings.
What was your parents' involvement in the disability community? Like, did you grow up going to buddy walks and fundraising, like, you know, local, whatever your local organizations were? Were you along for the ride and all those things?
Yes, definitely. So we did all those things all the time. My mom for a while was a stay-at-home mom, but she at one point went back to work and worked for a camp called Adams Camp in Colorado that provides therapy services and like adventure camp services for kids of all ages with disabilities. And so a lot of her work, which she started when I was in like late elementary, middle school age, was around supporting people with disabilities. And then my dad was on a variety of boards. And so it was a pretty common thing that we were always at events doing things. I spent a long time as a unified partner in Special Olympics. So it was pretty normal for me every summer to go to like the state games and be just alongside as a partner. I wasn't even really a coach. I would just like swim in the relays and it was just kind of normal. Right? It was just, just what we did. And then when I met my husband, I remember, I think our second date was a buddy walk. So
okay,
it's a good test.
Right. Like, let me show you what you're getting into here.
Yeah, just by the way.
Let me show you what it is that I come with. I love that.
Yeah.
Okay. It sounds like what I'm hearing you say is that it was just this normal thing to be a part of the disability space and the Down syndrome space, but you also got to be you and do your things. And it wasn't
exactly.
That's how I feel a lot of times when I talk to new parents who have a child first without a disability, and then they find out they're gonna have a child with Down syndrome and they're really overwhelmed. Like, what about my kids? Yeah. And I'm sure you hear this too. And that's why I appreciate so much the sibling perspective, because I can't answer that. But I also know in my home, it's just not a thing. Like, it's just, this is what our life is. No one knows any different. So there's not this like moment of like, this is what we do and this is what disability is and you will be an advocate. It's like, no, it's raising kids, you know, like every kid's their own person. And and so it sounds like that was a lot of your experience. And I would imagine too, we should have you back for a sibling episode. This is taking a turn, totally. But that I would imagine, and you can correct me, that there were things that felt challenging too of having a sibling with disability. Can you, we're going to stay on this track a little longer if you're okay with it.
Yeah.
Can you remember, like, was there an age that was harder or a season that was where you can like see a pain point having a sibling with Down syndrome for you?
I mean, I imagine it was adolescence. I don't know that I have like really specific ages, but I think especially once that gap in support needs starts to widen a little bit more and you start doing more and more different things, which I think on one hand is very normal, right? I also started to do very different things from my other sibling because we just had different interests and we're at different stages. But it also starts to become more obvious to other people how different the support needs are for somebody. Mm. And so it's just a little bit more in your face than, let's say, like the elementary school age, where it's, I think, in general, easier for everyone to just be kind of included and in the same spaces. It's also where people start to get mean. And so there's a lot more of the like comments, or sometimes you wouldn't even hear them. You could just tell that people were behaving differently, either to you as a pair or to either one of us separately. And so, you know, there's other challenges to adolescence. So sometimes it's hard to separate, like, what was related to that and what was just being a teenager. But also, like, I think the way I dealt with that a lot was I just spent a lot of my time in the disability space and I met friends there. And so a lot of the best friends I had in high school were the ones that were also unified partners at Special Olympics or that I met at the camps that we went to. And so it was nice to kind of feel like I had that safe space and didn't always have to be like somewhat battling perceptions. Every teenager probably needs that in some way.
That makes sense. Okay. And then another question.
Yeah.
Your parent, when things felt hard for you, do you have moments that you're like, my parents did this well, or I wish they had done this? You don't have to answer.
Yeah. No, I'm trying to think. I don't know that I have a great example right now, but
okay.
I do. One of the things I really remember was how my parents dealt with big challenges that my brother had at school. Because there was always a couple of times where like something big happened where he was like separated from other students to get on the school bus, or somebody at one point was taking money from him at school. And so I do remember that, you know, we'd have conversations about it, and it was something that was pretty open, and I got to kind of see how they navigated that. And I think that was really helpful, as hard as it was to kind of watch, and also understand how he experienced the world differently and kind of how to navigate that. I probably appreciate that more now as a parent than I did as a teenager. But
sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. Thank you for letting me go off on our little 10-minute tangent on that topic. I appreciate it. It, like I said, it is just, I feel like it's invaluable when you get to hear from an adult like who has a sibling with Down syndrome and how what that meant for you. And so then let's transition then over to our topic today. So then you become a doctor, right?
Yep.
And I'm assuming that there's a lot of inspiration from your brother and your lived growing up. So can you talk us through a little bit of your professional journey into working with individuals with Down syndrome?
Yeah. I went to medical school pretty sure I was going to work with adults with disabilities in some way, shape, or form. And my original plan was really to do developmental behavioral pediatrics, because that's like this concrete specialty that works with that population. It seemed like the clear path. But then I got to medical school and you do all these rotations and you experience all these different fields. And I realized that the adult space is where there's really nothing. And there's, as we'll talk about, this like cliff that exists in so many aspects of people's lives. And medicine is definitely one of them. It feels like everyone feels safe in this pediatric system. There's pretty good support. There's good services. Pediatricians are very well experienced in working with people with disabilities as a whole. But then you got to the adult world and people like somehow didn't know what to do and didn't know how to communicate with people with disabilities. And I was like, well, this is a gap, and this is where I'd like to work to fill it. The hard part is that there's not a formalized training path to like be specialized in caring for adults with IDD or with intellectual disabilities in the adult space. So you kind of had to figure out how to do that in your own way. And so I went through a variety of different potential paths, but ultimately ended up on family medicine and the primary care realm, because I felt like that's kind of the home base. That's the person that's supposed to be the overseer of all your care. And felt like these like long-term relationships you can form in primary care was really what I wanted to do. And so then I kind of just did a bunch of searching to find the right training program for me, which none of this is on any website anywhere. I just like went to like a fair that had all these residency programs and was like, I want to take care of people with intellectual disabilities. And I got a lot of blank stares, like, I don't know what you're talking about. I don't know how you would do that. But like then a couple were like, oh yeah, we have all these patients with developmental disabilities. We see a lot of patients from these different group homes or residential settings. Like everyone who leaves here will be well prepared. And I was like, great. So that's where I went. I went to a residency called Tacoma Family Medicine, where they just kind of have it naturally incorporated into their residency. And I think it's such a great model because it's not something different or unique. It's not separated. It's like, that's just what everyone does. And it's normal. And so that was a really good fit for me, and I loved that training. And so it was, you know, I don't necessarily have anything beyond that in training except for just that natural built-in stuff.
Yeah.
After that, I returned to Colorado after residency to work at the Developmental Disabilities Health Center in Colorado Springs, where we did primary care for adults with disabilities, and was medical director there for a couple of years. And now I'm out in Cincinnati, basically doing the same work.
Okay, so much fascinating stuff there. Why do you think, or what's your understanding and your thoughts about why in adult medicine there's such a void?
Yeah, I think, and I've said this to medical students before, but I think there's a little bit of the field of medicine as being a victim of its own success in a way. So historically, when there was less good medical care or less options to help prolong the lives of people with disabilities, many people with disabilities died in childhood. And so we've had this huge increase in the number of people with Down syndrome and other disabilities who are able to live healthy lives into adulthood. But the training and the system has not caught up to that yet, which I think is why the pediatricians are just, as a whole, again, there's exceptions on both ends of this, as a whole, they're better prepared in caring for kids with disabilities than the adult world. I would be remiss not to include, though, just kind of bias and stereotype. There's definitely still a lot of ableism that exists within the medical world. That's probably the foundation, and I think that's something we've been battling for years and years, and will continue to probably battle for years and years. But I think a lot of it's just that we're still relatively on the scope of history early in this period where people with disabilities are living healthy lives and aging, really.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That all makes so much sense. Mm-hmm. I think you're spot on.
Yeah.
So then let's talk about that transition period. Mm-hmm. And when does it start? When should a parent start thinking like we're here at the transition period? And let's start with that.
Yeah.
When do we start transitioning our kids from pediatric to adult medicine?
The earlier the better is what I'd say. I see it more as a process. Like, I think a lot of times people think of it in their heads as like this period in time. It's like one day I'm in the pediatric world and then one day I'm in the adult world. And really it's much more of a process than that. And so the guidelines that do exist around transition recommend even starting somewhere around 12 to 14 of thinking about this transition process, both in what it's going to look like, but also preparing the individual to kind of take over more and more of their own care and manage more of their medical care. And that looks different for everyone depending on their support needs. But the earlier, the better, because people feel a lot of times kind of caught off guard when they're just like, I get told in the clinic all the time, the pediatricians just kicked me out. And I'm like, okay, well, you know, we all knew this was coming, so it's not super surprising.
You know what your birthday is.
But I think we could do a much better job of kind of guiding people through this process early and kind of saying, this is around the age at which we expect you'll need to transition to an adult provider. These are the providers we can help set you up with. But I also find that parents don't necessarily know that they need to start asking those questions either. And so a lot of times people don't know, like, okay, well, is this specialist needing you to transition now? Or, you know, what does the plan look like? And they're like, oh, I've never asked them that. They've never brought it up.
Okay.
And so the earlier people ask their primary care, their specialist, like, okay, at what age do you expect I need to transition? The better prepared you can be so that it's not this, it doesn't feel like as abrupt of a process. Mm-hmm. That's like just the logistical side of it. But the other side is trying to be like, okay, you're going to be in the adult. How are we going to make sure that you can start to gain the skills to manage your medications in whatever way works for you and know what you're taking them for, who your doctors are, how you communicate that to other people? And then decision-making is another big aspect of that. And so what is it going to look like, whether it's supported decision-making, guardianship, power of attorney, you know, what is the best way to support this person in maintaining as much autonomy as possible, but also making sure we have what we need in place to make good decisions.
Yeah. Can you like walk me through? So my daughter Macy is 16.
Mm-hmm.
And so then I go to her pediatrician and I say what? Like, can we do like a pretend like it's happening?
Yeah.
And let me say real quick, too, Macy sees a like ophthalmology, pulmonology, and cardiology. So mm-hmm. she also has specialty doctors mm-hmm. that in my head for the very first time, Emily, in real time, I'm realizing are pediatric and that they're not with her forever.
Almost all of them are.
Or also, do doctors keep certain patients mm-hmm. past peds, or is it not smart for them to do that? These are a lot of questions.
It really depends, which is why it's so important to ask the question, because it varies a whole lot. And so I kind of think about it in different categories. So there's primary care, specialists, therapies as appropriate, medical equipment, and then hospital services for people anytime you need to be hospitalized. And so primary care and specialists are similar. I would just go to a doctor and say, you know, we're coming up on turning 18. At what point do you anticipate that you'd like us to transition to an adult provider and see if there's an age cutoff? At least here at Cincinnati, like at Cincinnati Children's, and I believe this is pretty standard across the board, there's not necessarily an age cutoff for every single specialty within the organization, because it varies so much depending on each individual specialty. And so that's why it's really important to ask every single person what that looks like. Primary care, I think a lot of people see pediatricians, but occasionally you'll have somebody who's family medicine or internal medicine pediatrics that can keep somebody, so all the better. But a lot of the other parts of transition still need to occur, even if you see a primary care that can see you forever.
Okay.
The thing about specialties is some of it changes when you get to the adult world too. So there are certain specialists that will continue to see you into adulthood. I think the most common of this is cardiology, and or just that adult congenital cardiology programs are based out of children's hospitals, depending on each individual program. So that's probably the most common place that stays at a pediatric system, even though sometimes it's an adult service. There's other really people with really complex or very specific medical needs will also still have pediatricians that will see them into adulthood. But it varies a lot and usually very individualized. And then certain specialists you don't need anymore in the adult space. The most common example for people with Down syndrome is endocrinology and for hypothyroidism. Usually primary care does that in the adult world. I manage almost everyone's hypothyroidism, no problem. And so there's certain things like that. And then the other common example is developmental behavioral pediatrics, which again just doesn't exist. So for the most part, primary care or psychiatry end up kind of taking over that side of things.
Okay.
So yeah, I would just ask.
Yeah, that's it. Just say it's time.
Yeah.
At your next appointment, which is great. I mean, so simple and so helpful. I would not have even thought to do that until I would have been the person that's like 18, shoot, like with her birthdays tomorrow, we gotta figure this out. Because it does, I think with my kids with Down syndrome, I don't know if it's true for all kids with Down syndrome or like more medically complex. Like I said, we see all these specialty doctors, my kids have had surgeries, like it's just, we've had a more intimate relationship with the medical field than other parents might.
Yep.
And so it's like, oh no, these are our people. It's like to think of them as not there in the future makes me kind of sad.
Yeah.
But it's also something that I need to think of because it's just like, no, we've done this for so long. Mm-hmm. These are our people.
Yeah.
So it's good to do that. And I would just say this too, and you probably can talk to this in talking about families and patients of yours. Transition is just hard.
Oh, yeah.
Like every transition feels so hard. And my kids transitioning from teen to adult, I want to crawl in a hole and just hide. It just feels so heavy. Yeah. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah. I think when I see people in clinic that are this like first transition appointment, it's a lot of that sentiment. I get pretty used to kind of helping to kind of bring this feeling down or like ease the tension a little bit. And part of that comes from what you're talking about of they know that they've known their pediatricians for years and years. They know what they need. They just kind of know everything. And they're like, why do I have to transition? why do I have to do this? It feels almost personal to a degree. But also I think the other thing that happens at this teen to adult transition is that everything is transitioning more or less all at one time. So a lot of times it coincides with school transition to either a day program or work or whatever you have after that. Therapies transition. You have to decide how to make decisions. And so all of a sudden it's just all of it all at once. And it feels very overwhelming. And there's rarely one person who can guide you through the whole thing. And so I get it. I mean, it's just super overwhelming because Yeah. You're going from a safe space to a not safe space, and then you're doing all of it all together.
Yeah. And I know, like, in my own heart, like, that internalized of, I can't, like, my kid is getting big.
Yeah.
I'm getting old. Like, all of them, like, just hits me at certain stages where I'm like, we just got to slow this down. Mm-hmm. We have to stop this whole.
Yeah. And I think the other thing I try to reassure people with when they're feeling that anxiety, especially when they're kind of like, you know, the adult system is not as friendly, it's not as welcoming, which is definitely true. But there does come a point at which the care that you receive in the adult system is better, because you do develop risks or you develop adult related medical issues, and you really need adult providers for that. Mm. It may not come as early as we transition, but it really is a thing. And so, you know, adults need adult medical providers. Yeah. And so it ends up being the good and the right thing in the long run, but it feels very jarring usually for people in the moment.
Yeah, I appreciate you affirming that. Can you talk a little bit more specifically about the services that become important for individuals with Down syndrome as they become adults?
Yeah. I think of this not only in transition from pediatric to adult, but also in aging. And so it's this transition, not only medically, but I think these community supports are so integrated into the health and well-being of people with Down syndrome. So one of the first things I'm always asking people about in this transition is their involvement or connection with the developmental disability department, the board of developmental disabilities in their county, state, however it's structured in their area. Because those are the residential supports, the job supports, all of those kind of life supports that really end up being quite important for people and ensuring that they have the opportunity to live really healthy lives. And then in the medical world, I mean, I'm a little biased, but I think a really solid primary care provider who can help navigate all these different pieces is also very important. And I think it doesn't necessarily have to be someone who works only with people with Down syndrome or who has this specialized experience, but just somebody who's really good at kind of seeing that whole person and navigating how to put all of these pieces of the puzzle together. Mm-hmm. Medical-wise, you know, there are some certain things that we keep an eye out for, and the Global Down Syndrome Foundation has some great adult-specific guidelines. So I do usually encourage people, individuals themselves and families, to kind of take a look at those and have some idea of what they include, because there is varying levels of knowledge about it from adult primary care providers. And so, you know, it's good for all of us to know kind of what preventive care things we need, what types of things to be looking out for.
Yeah, that's super helpful. You mentioned global. What other resources do you have for families during this transition period?
For transition specifically, not necessarily specific to Down syndrome, GOT Transition is one that has a ton of resources. I believe it's out of Canada, but they have a whole framework, and they have resources for individuals, for parents, and for healthcare providers on how to navigate that transition process. So it walks you through a lot of what we talked about, of like, all right, when do you start? What kinds of questions do you ask? The things I really like for individuals are they have these readiness checklists that go through like, okay, as an adult, I need to be able to call and set up a doctor's appointment. Like, how do I do that? Do I know how to do it? Or how do I get help doing it? And then it has like, okay, do I know my medications and how much I'm taking and why? So it kind of walks you through some of these areas that, as a whole, we expect adults to be proficient in by the time they enter the adult medical system, and helps parents kind of decide, all right, if we can't do all these things to the full degree, what supports do we need to have set up to make sure that somebody is helping them do it? And how do we promote that, the highest level of autonomy in managing medical care that we can?
Oh gosh, it's a lot. Yeah.
Yeah. It's so much.
It's so much. But we're not alone, listeners. Yeah. We've got a lot of people helping us, and we've got Emily here to lead the way. We're gonna give out your phone number. I hope that's okay. I'm just kidding.
Personal cell phone. Yeah.
I'm obviously just kidding about that. For any healthcare providers listening, what's like, how can healthcare providers better support families? What's like a couple of nuggets to share? And even for parents to bring, you know, as we are growing in our mm-hmm. advocacy. Like, hey, this would be helpful if you could do this.
Yeah. I think there's two kind of big categories. One, I think for the pediatric world, like I kind of mentioned before, preparing people a little bit better and starting that process early. Definitely. So most people come to me feeling unprepared, I think. And so it'd be great to have a little bit more support sometimes on the pediatric side of things to feel like, oh, they already know what specialists they need. They already know this. They already have some idea of how the adult system works and have set realistic expectations. On a whole, though, one of the things besides just kind of general comfort and educating themselves about people with different types of disabilities, I think some knowledge of the community support systems for people with disabilities would be really great for doctors to know. One of the first things I always ask students when they come work with me is, do you know what a Medicaid waiver is? Mm-hmm. And I think the only person who knew was another sibling of an adult with Down syndrome.
Yeah.
Everyone else is like, I've never heard of that. And this is a Medicaid system. So it's, you know, in theory, something you think we should all know about, mm-hmm. but really nobody's ever heard of it and they don't know what it does or how to access it. And for as complex of a system that it is and how much it, again, these are the systems that provide really community-based healthcare for people with disabilities. I think doctors should know what it is and how to access it and who's eligible. The hard part is it's different in every single state, sometimes in every single county. And so I still find it to be a very complex system and one that I don't fully understand. But I think if people had a little bit better understanding of that side of the spectrum, they'd be a lot better prepared.
Whoa, that's so interesting. I've never considered that doctors don't understand that system. Like, yeah. That there's not. But then as you say it, like, why would they if they don't need to? And can we just have some kind of petition to change everything and make it a little more streamlined? It's so we deal with anything, and we're in California, I'm like, is this a trick? Is everybody just trying to make this as difficult as possible? Can this be any more difficult? It can't. The hoops and the things, and you talk to this person who doesn't know what this person said, and they don't agree. And mm-hmm. what are we doing here? It's madness.
Yeah.
Sometimes. And sometimes it's amazing. And I have to give it credit. Like, we've had, my kids are covered because of these programs. Mm-hmm. And I'm so, so thankful. But Josh and I talk a lot, my husband's name is Josh, about I could not imagine moving out of the state because of that. Like, having to restart the Medicaid.
Yeah.
I can't even imagine. Yeah.
It's a nightmare. We did it as we moved from Colorado to Ohio, and prior to having our son, we lived in Washington. So I have some idea of like the Washington system, the Colorado system, and the Ohio system. And it is like drinking from a fire hose every single time. And it's different everywhere, which kind of drives me crazy. Yeah. But yeah, it's just so complicated to navigate, and you have to know what to advocate for, and you have to be able to be pretty savvy in understanding all of these systems and what different things mean. And most people don't. So mm-hmm. even just like a tiny bit of knowledge sometimes on the medical provider side would help a lot.
Yeah.
I've seen like medication errors. I've seen all sorts of things happen because of this poor communication between the healthcare system and the community-based support system. Mm-hmm. I wish I had an answer how to fix it, but it's a real thing.
Well, I think it's helpful that you in your field can say to medical students and to other medical providers, like, hey, if you can get a little bit of understanding about this, it goes a long way for our families, for sure.
Yep.
I think that's really helpful. I want to know about, well, I want to talk about your son, your child with Down syndrome, if that's okay with you. And before we do that, is there anything that we missed? I feel like you covered so much. You're very articulate and super helpful with all these details. Is there any other advice that you're like, you need the listeners to know when it comes to transition that we haven't covered yet?
Yeah. I think the one thing I would say is the more information you can bring to your new providers as well, the better. I think what I've observed is that people greatly overestimate the degree to which there's good communication and good transfer of information between healthcare systems. So even though, like for us, we are literally about two blocks away from Cincinnati Children's Hospital, but our electronic health records are not the same. And so I can see a lot of it, but it's just not this like smooth transfer of information as you might hope. And so the more of like a summarized version of things that you can bring a new doctor, they will appreciate that a lot, and it will help prevent any kind of mess ups or errors. The other thing is, I've talked to people and kind of, I gave a talk not too long ago at our local Down Syndrome Association about transition that I didn't realize people didn't know, is that your medication list is most likely has some errors in it in most health records. There's just so many hands in the system and so many changes and people that mess with it that there's usually some sort of small error that happens. And so I always encourage people, bring your medication list, your diagnosis list if possible, to like every single appointment. Okay. Just to kind of double check everything, because the next time you're at somewhere different, or you know, you have somebody new who's looking over your chart, they can have accurate information. It's such a complex system, and we wish we could have it be perfect every time, but that is just not the reality.
Yeah. When you're saying bring information, is this like I've typed something up, there's a notebook, am I asking for medical records to be printed? Like, what's the best way if you are my child's doctor and we're seeing you for the first time? What am I handing you?
In primary care, I would say some sort of just typed summary would be probably the ideal. I can find most of the medical records, but even just for time's sake, it's so helpful to have this, like, I don't know, 1 or 2 page summary that's like, these are all the things, these are all the doctors that we see, the medications that we have, the supplies that we have. And all of a sudden, you've saved that doctor probably 30 minutes of time.
Okay.
And so that can be super helpful. If some of it requires a little bit of knowledge of the different systems. But if you have that, then the doctor knows, okay, I can go find records in the system, or we're going to have to get those records faxed, or, you know, they have at least a good starting point of how they need to get the other information.
Okay.
If they have like the doctors that you see and the medications that you have and why you're on them.
Okay. Are we going back to like birth, like born at this hospital all, and then surgery at this at 4 months old, or are we doing more like current?
A little bit of both. So they, you know, I do want to know, for example, for adults with Down syndrome, like, did you have heart surgery, or what kinds of surgeries did you have?
Okay.
That being said, it can be very easy to overdo it. Like, we don't need to know about every ear infection, every like little detail. Sure. But I would say birth, if there was any certain complications or anything of note, if you stayed in the NICU for a while, that's helpful information. Surgeries are really helpful. Major hospitalizations. You know, we certainly have certain people that were hospitalized so many times, it's not worth it, but kind of any general trends on what you're hospitalized for, if that's the case, and then specialists and why you're seeing them and medications.
Okay. Yeah. Gosh, Emily, you're so helpful.
Oh, good.
Dr. Johnson, this is great. This is so great. Okay, I want to know about your family now, and that you're a sibling with Down syndrome, but you're also a mother to a child with Down syndrome. Can you tell us a little bit more about your family?
Yeah. So my husband and I talked about how we were going to build a family, I guess, for a long time. And we ultimately decided that we wanted to adopt, and we wanted to adopt a kid with Down syndrome because it was just something that felt really important to us as a family. And we were really excited to do that. Our son Noah joined our family in 2021. And I will say it was a whirlwind, because we started the home study in May of 2021, and he joined our family in November. So it was like 6 months. I think we were on the NDSAN registry for 2 weeks, I think, before 3 weeks, something like that, less than a month. Uh-huh. We didn't have anything. We were not prepared, but it was super fun. And we still stay in touch, and we see his biological mom every so often. And he's just so much fun.
Yeah,
it's been a really cool experience. And I feel like I get to relive a little bit of that, like just experiencing somebody as an individual. And like most of the time, I just like don't even think about the fact that he has Down syndrome and he's just Noah, right? And it's kind of like this like revisit of that kind of sibling experience for me. So it's been.
That is so cool. Tell our listeners who the National Down Syndrome Adoption Network, is that is that who you adopted with?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Okay. Yeah, so the National Down Syndrome Adoption Network is an organization based out of Cincinnati through the Down Syndrome Association of Greater Cincinnati. And so they work to match or pair adoptive families with expectant families or birth families of kiddos with Down syndrome who need adoptive families. Mm-hmm. And so they have a registry and they provide, one of the reasons we decided to go with them was because of all the counseling services that they provided. As I did a lot of research about adoption and specifically adoption of kids with Down syndrome, that was such an important part for me, mm-hmm. of knowing that by the time somebody was making a plan to adopt, that they had received just really extensive, really thorough counseling, and they knew that that was the right decision for them. Mm-hmm. Because both, I think, in the adoption world and in the medical world, there's just really poor counseling on both of those things. Poor counseling on adoption, poor counseling on Down syndrome. And so talking with Stephanie and like listening to her webinar, and I've fortunately gotten to meet her, she runs basically the whole program, I just felt really comfortable that by the time somebody was making this plan, they knew it was the right choice for them. Mm-hmm. And I think that's so important. And I wish she could counsel every family who receives a prenatal diagnosis of Down syndrome.
Yeah. That's such a good plug. And I love it because we actually had her on an episode. We'll have to find it, listeners, and put it in the show notes. But I love that about what they're doing too. Mm-hmm. Both my kids with Down syndrome came to me through adoption, and it wasn't through the National Down Syndrome Adoption Network. And uh-huh. so I think that there was a lacking of that. Mm-hmm. And even to the point of, I wanted to counsel them. Like, are you sure that this is, like, are you sure this is what you want to do? Are you sure? Are you sure? But it was just this weird, that's not my place. Like, it was,
right.
It gets a little bit murky and messy, as adoption is murky and messy.
Yeah. But
anyway.
Yeah.
I love that. And then do you have any other kids?
Not currently. No.
Okay. Just me. Well, maybe if you'll let us, I need to see a picture. I need a picture of Eric and Noah. So tell me about Eric as an uncle.
He loves being an uncle. My mom calls it the brotherhood because I think the first few times they met, and even still, like, Noah will just stare at Eric. Eric's my brother. Mm-hmm. And just like, it's almost like they have some sort of knowledge that they have this shared bond that they don't with other people. And so that's always how my mom refers to their little like mm-hmm. special connection that they have. Occasionally they like, no, will annoy Eric. And that's just, you know, how it goes.
Yeah, right?
he's a 2.5-year-old. That's just what 2-year-olds do.
Yeah.
But it's super fun to see them interact. And yeah, such a lovely experience. They were just in town because my family still lives in the Denver area. And so they were just in town over the weekend. And I just loved having any opportunity to get them together.
Oh, it's so great. I love it. I just love the thought of all of it. Emily, you are such a gem. Thank you.
Oh, thank you.
Dr. Johnson, for taking the time. Thanks for the work that you're doing in the medical field. I hope that you are often applauded for that, and we applaud you here on the podcast. It sounds like you found a gap, and you're working really hard to fill that space in such a necessary way with such a good perspective of like the humanity in a person with Down syndrome is an individual human being mm-hmm. worthy of all the things. So I appreciate your heart and your hard work in taking the time to be with us today. Thank you so much.
Of course. Yeah. Thank you for having me again.
We're going to take a break and be right back.
At 23 weeks of pregnancy, my third baby received a prenatal diagnosis of Down syndrome. I spent his early years struggling to explain his value in a world that continually questioned his worth. I wanted to say that he was uniquely valuable, even blessed. That overused, often trite hashtag of a religious word no one ever really knows how to define. On April 9th, I'll release a book about my story of raising Ace, who lives with Down syndrome and autism, and who doesn't speak. The book is an exploration of an ancient poem deeply important to my faith, a poem that asks the question of what it means to be blessed, what it means to be whole. Because in the dream of God, in the really real, blessing is rarely what we think it is. I hope you'll go to Target, Barnes & Noble, Amazon, or your local bookstore to buy Blessed Are the Rest of Us. Or you can order from Baker Bookhouse online and get 40% off when you use the code SLOWAY at checkout. That's SLOWWAY.
Unfortunately, we have to wrap up this episode. I hope that you're leaving with so much goodness and knowledge in your head. Emily, thank you again for being with us, for sharing so accurately and articulately and openly about your experience and giving us all those tools and all that helpful information. I hope that, and maybe save this one if your kid's a little younger and come back to it. I'm going to be doing that as well. And we wanted to let you guys know that we love you, our listeners, and we have opportunities for you guys to help us shout worth and shift narratives by becoming a monthly supporter of the Lucky Few podcast. For 99 cents, $4.99, or $9.99 a month, you can help us continue the work that we're doing here. Your support makes a difference and it helps give us the opportunity to create this meaningful content, covers production costs, and be able to explore additional opportunities to expand all of our resources here at the podcast. So we really appreciate you considering that and becoming an essential part of the Lucky Few movement today. And thank you, Josh Avis, for editing this episode, and Ashley Fracalossi for producing it. Friends, share this episode with your medical team, with your family. What else? Check out the luckyviewpodcast.com for show notes and all the things we talked about today. And make sure you're following on social media at the Lucky Few Pod. And hey, everybody listening, moms and dads and grandparents and health providers and educators and siblings, we love you all. We're here for you. We're always cheering you on, and we can't wait to be together for another episode next week. Until then, goodbye.